From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Alan Weisman is my guest. No stranger to NPR listeners, he is the author of the bestseller World Without Us, and his new book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And in this book, he informs us that we are screwed. Alan Weisman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks very much for having me on, though I'll have to say that, frankly, if I thought we were screwed, I wouldn't have bothered to write this book because it was an enormous amount of work. It would have been so much easier just to sit home and drink. And I really actually came out of the book more hopeful than I went into it.
Well, you know, I was on my way to the station here today to talk to you, and I live in this town, Santa Cruz, California. And it used to be, when I first moved here, it was such a quiet place. There was hardly anybody around. I got caught in a traffic jam. You wouldn't believe it was like 20 minutes longer than planned to get to the station today. I guess I've lived long enough that I can feel what it's like to be in a world of, you know, I guess the population has doubled in my lifetime. How bad is it going to get?
Well, I think that pretty much everybody, no matter what age they are, remembers a time when you could get to some place that wasn't too far from where you lived and you could get away. You could go out and you could, you know, hike or picnic or walk under the trees or cut trees or, you know, look at birds or shoot birds if that's what you like to do. But now those places are gone. They've been buried under condominia or strip malls or industrial parks. And that's something that I found that everybody can relate to and why so many people have been relating to what I've been writing about. How bad is it going to get or how much worse? Well, if population doubled in your lifetime, that would mean that you were born in the 60s when it was about half of what we are today, 7.2 billion. And right now, the projections, which have, if anything, been conservative, is that by the middle of the century, we're going to add nearly another 2.5 billion. And by the end of the century, unless something happens, which I suspect it will, we're going to be at nearly 11 billion. And I don't think we can get there.
11 billion is just too many people to be on the planet?
Well, quite possible that 7.2 billion is too many people to be on the planet. As you may have noticed, the planet seems to be bursting its seams. Perhaps if we were all hunter-gatherers, well, even then we probably couldn't do it because there simply wouldn't be enough game. We did a pretty good job of extirpating an awful lot of game just when there were only 10,000 or so Homo sapiens in the Americas. What we're seeing, though, is, you know, we're a population that's addicted from birth to man-made energy, concentrated energy, which comes mainly from fossil fuels. And that means that the overwhelming amount of what we do causes stuff to go up our chimneys or out our exhaust pipes into the atmosphere, and it's like packing the atmosphere with insulation. So things are warming up on this planet. There are an infinitesimal number now of so-called scientists who disagree with that. The overwhelming majority know that this is happening because we have so much carbon dioxide in the air compared to what we had before the Industrial Revolution. It tracks completely with what we've been doing. In fact, so much that the last time we saw this amount was 3 million years ago. The seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. Also, 15 million years ago, same thing, same sea level elevation. So this is going to really disrupt those coastal cities over there in California and coastal cities all over the planet. I don't know how to curb our consumption of fossil fuels really quickly. We're going to have to phase them out over time because we just don't have the uptake of renewables that I wish we had. And we still don't know how to run all of our vehicles, for example, on renewables. So one thing that we do have the technology for is over a generation or two, bringing down our population so there are fewer people consuming all this stuff and expelling all this carbon dioxide and impacting the planet. that's probably the fastest thing that we could do to improve the environmental prognosis for our species.
So you're talking about death panels? No, I know you're not talking about death panels.
You know, I want everybody alive to live a happy, healthy, and long, prosperous life. But I think that in the future, we just have to recruit fewer replacements for us, meaning everybody needs to have fewer children than what the average has been over the last couple hundred years, when, particularly the 20th century, when human population quite suddenly doubled and then doubled again all in the space of a century.
Well, there's a few things that I want to ask you about that. Human beings are getting smarter and smarter and smarter. That is, we can solve so many problems. There's still cancer, but so many other diseases have been eliminated. People have stopped smoking in large numbers as they used to. And people are just living much, much longer than
right.
they used to. And, birth defects and so many of the other things, have been drastically reduced. But the majority of human beings still think that reproduction is a really good idea. So how do you change it?
Well, first of all, reproduction is a really good idea. We, like every other species, are programmed to make copies of ourselves. But we were also, like every other species, programmed to make a lot of extra copies of ourselves, because up until, I can tell you exactly when, 1798, more human beings died than survived to their fifth birthday. I mean, it was probably terribly painful for our ancestors, but our population, the population of Homo sapiens, barely grew for most of human history because so many babies died. Women might have seven or eight, but little more than two on the average survived. So our population crept up. 1798, cure for smallpox was vaccination was the first major medical advance, and that was followed by more vaccinations, pasteurization of milk, the discovery of antiseptics, all kinds of things. So, as you say, people started living longer, but much more important, fewer babies died. Infant mortality was way down, so suddenly we had a growth spurt, and that took us above a billion, and by the end of the century, the year 1900, there were 1.6 billion. And then something huge happened. We learned how to pull nitrogen artificially out of the sky and chemically slather it on the land to grow crops. That enormously increased the amount of plant life that nature was capable of producing. Before, there were a few nitrogen-fixing plants out there, like legumes. But suddenly we could do it ourselves. And this was probably the most important invention in the history of our species. A couple of German scientists invented it. It's known as the Haber-Bosch process. Most of us don't even recognize the name.
You don't hear much about that.
It was developed just before World War I, commercialized around the 1930s, and without it, 40% of it wouldn't be here. It enabled our population to double. And then,
because there was so much more food, or what?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. We could grow much more plant life, which is the basis for our entire food chain. And then in the 1960s was something called the Green Revolution. We learned how to grow much more grain per stalk of wheat or rice or corn. And that staved off an awful lot of famines that were about to pop all over the developing world. And today you oftentimes hear people say, and this speaks directly to your question, but we got the technology and the ingenuity to feed everybody. This disproved Malthus, who predicted that there would be famines, or Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who wrote a book called The Population Bomb, which helped touch off the environmental movement in the 60s. They predicted those famines that didn't happen because of the Green Revolution. But this is very selective thinking to suggest that they were debunked, because the founder of the Green Revolution, a guy named Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize because he's credited with saving more lives than anybody in human history, which is true, when he accepted that speech, he said, look, we've just bought some time, because unless we combine enhanced food production with population control, we're going to be in enormous trouble. because they understood that the more people you feed, the more people survive to have more children, who then have more children. So for this book, Countdown, that I've just written, I went, first of all, to the Green Revolution Centers, and they told me the story about Borlaug. They said he was on the board of population groups until he died in 2009 because he was so concerned about this. But I also went to India and Pakistan, the two places where the Green Revolution was tried out first. India is about to surpass China in this decade as the most populous nation on Earth, and Pakistan is just out of control. This is a country of nearly 190 million people, and it's the size of Texas, which only has 26 million people. By the middle of this century, it's going to have, at present growth rates, many more people than the present-day United States, nearly 400 million, and it'll still be the size of Texas. And it can't possibly employ all these people, so it's filled with underemployed, unemployed, frustrated, angry young men who become what we like to call terrorists in this country, and with some reason. This country's a nuclear power. Dwight D. Eisenhower, back in the 1950s, identified overpopulation as the biggest single global security risk in the post-war era. And traveling for this book to 21 countries, I began to understand what he meant.
Well, we're talking with Alan Weisman, and his new book you just mentioned is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Well, you know, there's this guy, maybe you heard of him, he's called the Pope. And he thinks that...
Yeah, I go to the Vatican in this book, too.
He thinks contraception is a sin. So what kind of good Catholic are you, Alan Weisman?
Well, first of all, I was not born Catholic, but actually one of my greatest mentors in life is a Catholic priest, and he's in the book, too. But I went to the Vatican to understand how it is that they can't get behind contraception. And I learned a bunch of things. First of all, in the 1960s, when the birth control pill suddenly took the world by storm, and suddenly, as I discovered in one of my journeys in Latin America that's recounted in this book, there were lots of defections from the Catholic Church to Protestant, various Protestant denominations, and this is only accelerating right now. By the end of the century, Catholicism will probably be a minority religion in Latin America. And the reason was a lot of these Protestant churches suddenly saw vulnerability. And they put out all these radio commercials saying, what, does your church say that you're a sinner because you want to be responsible and have only the number of children that you can take care of and properly raise and feed? Our church loves you for being responsible. So suddenly Catholic women who wanted to use these birth control pills started defecting. So Vatican II began to examine this question, and there was a commission. And ultimately, the commission, which is part lay Catholics and part bishops, voted 69-10 to legalize contraception under canon law. But then a Polish bishop by the name of Karol Wojtyla, who later, of course, became John Paul II, wrote a dissenting opinion pointing out that the church had a little problem. And that problem was that in the middle of the 19th century, it used to have a lot of land. It was called the Papal States. It was about a third of what today is Italy. But it lost that land in a social uprising. So it came down to the 110 acres it is today, Vatican City. And in order to still have any power in the world, I mean, Vatican City has only got 1,000 people who live there, and most of them are male, they came up with a very clever idea called papal infallibility. You know, suddenly this pope is talking, you know, God's talking through his mouth, so that's power, right? But the problem is, as the future Pope John Paul II pointed out, is that if they suddenly reverse track and said, okay, we're changing our mind on this thing, he says, essentially, we're going to say that we, for the most of the 20th century, we were mistaken on birth control. And of course they wanted no birth control because they wanted a lot of Catholics to be born. They said, we were mistaken and the Protestants were wrong. and papal infallibility will have just been nullified, because we'll prove that we could make a mistake from the Holy See. So the Pope is painted into a corner. He can't change his mind on this one, because if popes are infallible, that means every pope who came before the present one was also infallible. So that's a problem. But
that, like I said, we're screwed.
Yeah, but that 110 acres, no, not at all. That 110 acres is surrounded by a Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet, because something that I discovered in many countries that I went to, including some Muslim countries, because everybody gets scared about in Europe about Muslims taking over, that the best contraception of all is educating females. Italy's fertility rate is so low, among other reasons, but principally because it has the highest number of females with graduate degrees in the world. A woman who's in school nearly always defers her childbearing until her studies are done. And once it's done, she's got something interesting and useful to do with her life. She wants to be a mother, perhaps, but you can't exercise those skills that you've gained through your education if you've got seven kids hanging on you. So overwhelmingly, rich country, poor country, educated women, get them through high school. The average number of children they have is two or fewer. And if that were the case, two being population growth neutral, because two people replace themselves, anything lower than that, population is reduced. And that would, educating females would be the easiest way to bring our population down towards sustainable numbers. And many countries in the world are doing that.
But, Alan Weissman, you mentioned a minute ago that there was a threat of terrorism from overpopulated nations like Pakistan. And one of the sources of terrorism, or not, I mean, one of the triggers of terrorism is Western nations forcing their ideology on other countries.
Also true.
So, I mean, there are Muslim countries that believe that educating women is wrong.
Well, actually, not. There are very, very fundamentalist Muslims who believe that. Unfortunately, there are extremists in every religion on earth. In fact, I start out this book in Israel and Palestine, and we see the extremists on both sides trying to outpopulate each other to be the majority in this land that is basically a sandbox. Extremists are so set in their ways, and they've got a single agenda, a single item agenda, that they forget the context. And the context is that we live on a planet that isn't growing. And that's really a problem. But I show several examples in this book of countries that have, without using government intervention like China did with the one-child policy that everybody hates, that have come down to replacement rate or below, including free Muslim countries. Tunisia is one. Bangladesh is another, which is the alter ego of Pakistan, because that used to be part of Pakistan. They broke away, and one of the first things they did was institute family planning so they wouldn't grow out of control. And, that was only in 1980. It takes two generations to really start to see the drop, because you need for that, last old big generation to die off. But Bangladesh is in much better shape than Pakistan is. The third country is Iran. It was the last country that I went to, and I went there because in the 1980s, just following the Islamic Revolution there, it had the highest population growth rate on earth. Reason is that Saddam Hussein had invaded them, and he wanted to grab this oil-rich province on their border, and Saddam Hussein then had the backing of NATO. He had sophisticated weaponry. He even had we gave him the fixings for nerve gas. So the Iranians tried to get every woman to get pregnant and build a 20-million man army to repel the invaders, and they did manage to hold them to a stalemate after 8 years. Once that war was over, they realized that they were going to have a terrible problem, because all these kids were going to grow up and they wouldn't be able to employ them all. They were going to essentially the same problem that Pakistan has today. So they did four things. First of all, they told people you could have as many children as you want, but The only thing that was compulsory was premarital classes, which frankly is a good idea for anybody. And if you've been married, you know exactly what I mean. In those classes, among other things, they learned what does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, educate a child. A fatwa was issued saying there's nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates you've got the number of children you can comfortably raise, that you can't use, you know, anything from condoms up to an operation, a vasectomy or a tubal ligation. Third, they made all that stuff available. A very devout Muslim woman, an OBGYN, told me about these horseback brigades that they took with surgical units into the smallest villages all over, making sure that everybody had access to contraception so they could use it if they chose. And the fourth thing, again, they encouraged women to stay in school. And this is a country that back then, you know, only about a third of the women could read or write. Today, 60% of university students in Iran are female, and they came down to replacement rate a year faster than China in a totally voluntary program. So we can do this kind of stuff. It's also quite inexpensive. I'll be happy to talk to you about that.
Well, what can we all do? By the way, everybody, we're talking with Alan Weisman, and his new book is called Countdown. What can we do?
Well, simply this. One of the things that the United States is doing that I truly appreciate is that USAID, our foreign aid apparatus, is the biggest provider of contraception to the non-Western, to the developing world. And in some places where they don't want us telling them what to do, but they have recognized that this is something that they want to do, they simply take our logo off, that says, this is a gift from the American people. And, there's no problem with that, because the most important thing is that contraception is out there so women can choose how to use it. Right now, there's a funding worldwide. A lot of it comes from us. There are about four private foundations and a few other Western countries. If we doubled what's out there right now, and I'm talking about $8.1 billion annually, that would be enough to provide contraception for anybody on Earth who wanted it. Now, $8.1 billion is less per year. That's less than the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan for most of the last decade. This is something that's really affordable. And it doesn't involve any technological leaps like, across-the-board zero-emission energy. This is something we already know how to do. And in my book, by the way, talks about new male contraceptives that are coming online now that are, frankly, much simpler than a lot of female contraception and could help us share the burden with our sisters on this planet.
And do you think men would be willing to do this? Men have notoriously been not willing to help, right?
Well, there's an awful lot of men who get vasectomies. I mean, one of the processes that I'm talking about is something much simpler than a vasectomy, and it's totally reversible. It involves an injection into a little tube through which semen passes. It doesn't stop the semen from passing. It just kills the sperm, and it can be reversed with an injection of baking soda. So there are, I think that men will probably appreciate this. And more, I mean, I think we're coming to appreciate the fact, as you started out this conversation, that, damn, it's getting too crowded. Now, the fourth question that I asked in this book, number one being how many people can, be on this planet without tipping it over. Number two, how much nature do we need to preserve ourselves? Number three, is there something in all of the majority of cultures on this planet that would accept, so to speak, embracing, refraining from embracing a bit in times of need? The fourth one is, how do we design an economy for a population that isn't totally growing? Because we always think of economic growth as being the definition of health. All those housing starts, another way of saying sprawl that you don't like. And
right, but if you cut the population or reduce the population, then there won't be enough people to sell all of our goods to, and that would be bad for the economy.
Well, yeah, you're going to cut the number of consumers, and also economists constantly wine that, you know, oh, but you're going to have many fewer younger people and you're going to have all these older people and that's going to be a disaster. Well, first of all, that so-called disaster only happens for about a generation and a half, because then that older generation starts dying off and then the numbers balance out again. But in the interim, first of all those senior citizens, you know, they don't become economically non-productive at 65 anymore because of those health improvements that we talked about earlier. People can keep working. I know lots of people, peers of mine, myself, over 65, we can keep working. And kids, on the other hand, they're an economic liability because until they're about 18, you're just spending money on them. They're not producing anything. You have to give them a lot of food, and you have to build schools for them. One of the reasons why pro-growth economists like big populations is because it makes labor cheap. You know, they want a lot of poor people competing with each other for the lowest salary that gets offered. And at one point in this book, I'm in Japan, which actually has a shrinking population now. They're the first country that really does, because they had to cut off their baby boom after World War II because they lost the war and people were starving to death. So they legalized abortion. This was before the birth control pills. And now they've got a much smaller generation of baby boomers that's replacing that last overgrown generation that was born before World War II. And a very distinguished economist from Japan told me that, you know, this is really a natural transition towards a stable and steady state non-growth economy. And he says, and it's going to be fine. In the future, wages will remain high because workers being fewer will be more valuable. But as demand decreases for all those consumer goods, working hours will be fewer, so people will have more leisure time and they're going to have more space to enjoy it in. And they're going to reorient from these heavy export, raw resource-dependent industries that need crowded port cities to inland cities that are, you know, there's more space out there, and a lot of these are being vacated by this older generation of Japanese farmers that have died off. So it's really kind of a nice vision for the future, and time doesn't permit us to go into everything that I talk about in the book about the economics of this. But I found economist after economist who were willing to stand up to those traditional economists and say, wait, this is really very workable. And even Adam Smith, the uber capitalist who kind of defined capitalism for us all, if you go back and read what he wrote, he said at a certain point, growth cannot continue, you know, indefinitely. We have to level off to a stable, optimum place and maintain stability. And that's what we're going to have to do if we don't want to keep screwing up the atmosphere and turning our seas more into acidic Perrier, basically. There are many, many benefits for doing this, including, by the way, all those educated women. They will definitely help that labor shortage transition.
Well, Alan Weisman is my guest, and obviously he's brilliant, and his book is called Countdown, and it tells us that maybe we're not as screwed as I thought. Countdown, our last best hope for a future on Earth. Alan Weisman, thank you so much for sharing some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
What a pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Alan Weisman, his latest book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.